We all love a good henge. Stonehenge, Woodhenge, Seahenge, Averyhenge, etc., etc. And now, apparently, Manhattanhenge. Thank you, Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Shameful.
But what exactly is a henge? And more importantly, what do we make it mean when we call something a henge? Let's talk about that, don't you think, Mr. Soskin?
I think we really should.
Before we start off, a word of thanks to our Patreon supporters for being our guinea pigs for a lot of the ideas and shows that actually make its way onto YouTube. Because we wouldn't be having this conversation now, would we, Rupert, if it hadn't been for the regular monthly, weekly podcast that we do just for our Patreon supporters called The Monday Moot. And we sort of test our ideas, and sometimes they're so good they actually make it out into the the wider world, like this one has. Yes, well, yes. That good.
Yes. Well, it's surprising actually how many things that you take for granted because they've been there forever, and it's only when somebody asks a specific question that you realise that that does warrant further. Yeah. Investigation. So yes, this is
anyway. Thanks to our Patreon supporters for your support and your sufferance, much appreciated. Anyway, yes. To the subject in hand, the word henges, whatever. Where to start?
Well, we could start with just our basic definition now, couldn't we? And then you can.
Well, how did the word get made in the first place? How did the word itself come into existence in the first place? I think that's the best way. Yeah, because the definition came after the word was already in existence and in use. Yes, so that way round.
In fact, what we understand today, good Lord, does it have a misty past? From between the wars, in fact, you've got all those dates in front of you, haven't you?
Oh, yes. Well, we're talking about the origins of the word. The word was first used in a book called Archaeology in England and Wales, 1914 to 1931, i.e. between the war years, written by Thomas Kendrick. And I've forgotten the fellow that wrote it with him. So... But they wrote separate chapters, so the other fellow, whose name I've forgotten and I'll probably put on the screen now, doesn't take credit for this because he didn't write the particular chapter in which the word henge was coined. Now, the interesting thing is that Thomas Kendrick, who later went on to be the general curator thingy of the British Museum, so he was up there, it didn't set out to create a new word. He just used he shortened it. He took it from Stonehenge and Woodhenge, which are already in general use, but he used it at the heading of a chapter in order to organise some of the topics, some of the subject matter that had arisen in those interwar years, where archaeology had been going on. So it's just a sort of handy sort of shorthand to group some monuments together. The title of the chapter is chapter 7 in that book, and it's called The Henge Monuments, in inverted commas. So he's conscious of it's just, I'm making this up just for the time being, because it's he says... Under this rather curious heading, I'm going to group a number of prehistoric sacred places, which I cannot or dare not sort out into period chapters. I choose the title, of course, because Stonehenge and Woodhenge come first in the list. And that's it.
Yes, and then we have nearly a century of a word being used when it had no basis on anything other than a man's personal notebook.
And later on in that introduction, he apologises to readers for including Avebury, Durrington Walls, Dorchester, and one other, which, of course, later go on to be absolute. hinges. Yeah. So we could go on about the origins of that for some time. You know, we're excluding the origins of, you know, the creation of the word Stonehenge, because that's something completely different, because, you know, where the word is derived from, that's a different, the etymology of Stonehenge is a different matter. But henge, in the way we use it, is another matter. Now, the thing is, that's its beginnings in the 1930s. But where are we now? What do we understand? There is a definition which is quite separate from the way it seems to be used outside in the real world. So what's the technical definition that's come to be adopted, and how did it become to be adopted in the archaeological world?
Well, yes, I mean, technically, a henge is a circular monument. Don't like to use the word monument, but we'll use it. That has a ditch and an outer bank. That's basically it. And they are 20 metres and over. Things smaller than that are very often referred to as hengiform.
Yes.
just to confuse the issue. Mm. But yes, it's a circular monument with a ditch and a bank outside that ditch. Mm. Hmm. Which is why Stonehenge isn't that a henge, is because the bank is outside the ditch. Yeah,
and that is what has come to be, strictly speaking, which is why, as in the title here, Stonehenge is not a henge. How on earth did that come to be? I think Stonehenge sort of gets looped under a subheading called Proto-Henge.
Yes, it did. Yeah. It is. Which I confess, before we decided that we'd do this, I hadn't even registered that. Mm, mm. I can't tell a lie. So a proto-henge, because it was amongst the earliest, apparently.
But by that definition, Stonehenge is not a henge, having its bank on the outside. I think there's a lesser bank outside that outer ditch, but that's another matter entirely. Mm. So the truth of the matter is that we can lay the blame for a lot of the confusion, I think, at the foot of our friend, Professor Timothy Darville, because we hadn't realised this before we started investigating. We said, we're lost, Tim. I sent an email. We're lost. We're doing this thing about henges. We don't know what happened to the word and how it got defined. And he sort of emails back saying, well, I know.
Yes.
It turns out he's written three 15-page documents, you know, 45 pages in all, as a definitive document for English Heritage to use as a definition. So
quite some time ago,
1989, and it's very technical and detailed, you know, which so archaeologists understand each other and know what language they're using inside, you know, the discipline needs must be, but that's where the confusion arises, how you get from a word derived from Stonehenge that ultimately excludes Stonehenge. You know, the head explodes slightly. However, all that aside, that, you know, all that's nice and very esoteric. This is all of it, but it's esoteric, really, come to think of it. But we hope you find it interesting nonetheless. So, but how does that word henge get used in the real world? How is it used in common parlance? And what does it make it, when we call something a henge, what are we thinking about? What do we make it mean that a monument is a henge?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think there's a very different understanding between archaeologists and people who actually have a knowledge of archaeology, who understand the technical definition of henge. But I think out there in the wider world, then that understanding just completely falls by the wayside. I mean, the very fact that you mentioned, you know, at the top of the show, that there's now Neil deGrasse Tyson has called the sun streaming up. Which road is it? It's called Manhattan.
It's not a road in particular. It's the east-west orientation of the grid system, which creates this phenomenon.
So the very fact that that could have been coined a henge. What is he referencing there? You know, a reference to the sun's passage in the sky, which actually has very, very little to do with henges. It's more to do with other monuments entirely.
Well, except
so it really just doesn't confuse the
issue. He relates it to a visit to Stonehenge when he was 15, apparently, you know, and the alignment of Stonehenge, basically. So there we go. And that kind of feeds into my conjecture, my thought that because the word henge is derived from Stonehenge, when we call something a henge, we bring a lot of baggage with us from Stonehenge and impose it on whatever we've given the name to. And because Stonehenge is anomalous in its own right, and of all the circular earthworks, monuments, call them what you will, because of its particular arrangements and its uniqueness, it is fair to say that the whatever went on there was ceremonial. It may have been a temple of some sort. It may have been ritual of some sort. And because in this country we've got all sorts of baggage associated with that, we blame William Stukeley and, you know, in the association with the Druids.
And John Aubrey.
John Aubrey, all those. And because of this embedded association with the Druids, that when we apply the word henge to something, it suddenly takes on this spiritual and quasi-religious aspect to it.
Am I mystical,
wrong in that, do you think?
No, I think it's absolutely right. And in fact, we use these words, you know, ritual and ceremonial, with, if we're brutally honest, not one scrap of evidence to actually support that interpretation, and no evidence at all. So it's interesting how that's just developed over time. You know, our interpretations of them are something quite different a lot of the time. But like so many sites, you know, undoubtedly multi-purpose, and probably the function changing over periods of time, because they were certainly in use for fairly lengthy periods of time.
So
I mean, we're stuck with this. Well, not stuck with, you know, that definition of a circular, almost arena style setting with a ditch surrounding this central plateau, and then an outer bank. Well, there's all manner of uses of functions that you could hypothesize for that. And ritual and ceremonial is...
That you could. You probably, if you're familiar with our thinking, you'll know that we definitely do. Yes. But that's another program.
This is another program. I think there are certain particularly interesting things that can be said about the structures of henges, though, that... people have debated a lot in the past about the functions of multi-ditched henges. So, for example, you know, henges that can have two ditches or three ditches even. And the interesting thing there is that you know, they've often been theorized as being just, you know, fancy henges, that there was some ritual purpose for making an extra ditch. But if you look at underlying geology, then that sort of points you in a different direction, in our view anyway. So, for example, if you take somewhere like Abingdon in Oxfordshire, I believe. Now, Abingdon is a double-ditched henge, and it's overlying gravel. Now, if you dig down too far, then the gravel, it's overlying a bedrock, it's just going to collapse. So what do you do if you want a higher bank? Will you dig an outer ditch? Dig a second ditch that will give you sufficient soil for the bank. Now, an interesting thing that that actually reinforces that argument is that the inner ditch is actually quite neat and circular, and the outer ditch is all over the place, which means that if it's designed for people to be looking inwards, then the tidiness of inside is important, but outside the ditch was purely to gain more soil, so didn't need to be tidy. Nobody's looking at that. And another site called Condicut, that's overlying, that's basically clay soils overlying a very solid limestone bedrock. So digging down to get sufficient soil, it's just shallow soil, so they would need more ditches to create the height of the bank. So, you know, the double-ditched henges, it's functional. It's not mystical in any way, in our view.
Okay, right. So you've gone a bit deep there. I mean, this is a wonderful material for, you know, when we are talking about our hypotheses about henges. We've got so much material about on that. However, going back a bit, it is my contention that this baggage that is associated with the very word itself, where, you know, out in the public sphere, fair enough, you know, you get what you're given, but I think it pervades in archaeologists' minds as well. So that there is a default position whenever they're examining, you know, a circular earthwork, that there's it's associated with henge, with Stonehenge, with ritual, with druids, not consciously necessarily, the brain goes first to thinking about it as a religious site, a ceremonial site, a ritual site, for which there's no escape. You can't prove it one way or the other. You're stuck there. Instead of thinking, for instance, oh, was this something to do with farming, with herding cattle? You know, just something like that, which you can, you know, you've got a slight chance, some chance of proving whether or not, or, you know, getting evidence for it or not. You know, which it seems a much more constructive point of view from our point of view, way of approaching these things. What we're trying to do is strip away this mystique, that strip away the connotations of this word, so we can approach the subject a bit more cleanly without all this baggage. You can't take that away in the public sphere. Of course, you know, a henge is a henge is a henge, and, you know, will forever be what people use it for. It becomes common parlance. It's really, really hard to shift that.
I think it doesn't help at all that we refer to these sites, not just henges, but any of the prehistoric sites, we refer to them as monuments.
Monuments. We could do another program about monuments.
Then you give it a grandiose position that maybe it never had. I think we should stop calling things monuments.
We'll have to think of a lot of nouns that we...
You saying noun.
Oh, right? Yes.
It's worth saying verb, because Scottish archaeologist Kenny Brophy, Kenny says that it should be a verb, henging. You know, if you give something a ditch and a bank, then you have henged a site. And to me, that makes a lot of sense, because, then whether it's Stonehenge not technically being a henge, okay, but it's been henged.
It's helpful
to give something a ditch and a bank, and that could apply to other places. You know, a cursus, you know, with an outer ditch, for example, and bank. I think henging should be a verb.
I think it's really helpful to think that way. It breaks things apart. You know, sort of has them be looked at in a different light.
Yeah.
Before we sort of round this up, I think, to further emphasise what we're talking about, we think, you know, Stonehenge, very English, obviously. Woodhenge, just down the road, very English. But henge is an English word. And the thing is, there are earthwork enclosures on the continent which are entirely similar to what we name henges. They've never, ever been called henges on the continent, obviously. And, I mean, the word that is used, the German word, Kreisgrabenanlagen, or the simple word Rondel, tells you almost everything you can know about what they are. Like, they're round, and they've got ditches and banks, and that's the end of it. And there is no romance associated with the names used on the continent with these things. And therefore, they tend to be approached in a more pragmatic fashion, you know, in terms of their association with settlements and their possible usage for those settlements. That said, we're very conscious of the fact that the vast majority of them predate our own Stonehenge by about 1,000 or 1,500 years. So, you know, way before
but
Stonehenge.
Why should that surprise us when we know that we've had migrations of people coming into Britain from continental Europe? It makes sense that they'd be later catching up on themselves. But it is very interesting, I think, that not just with henges, but so you're talking about the pragmatic, naming of sites, you know, the rondels and roundels, whichever. The same applies, though, to some of the houses that are found in Eastern Europe. They are regarded as houses, whereas pretty much without exception, when anything gets found in Britain, it's called a temple. We just have a different attitude to things.
Now, interestingly, and just to nail my earlier point about how, you know, archaeological thinking can be influenced, and, you know, I'm this is what I take. It may or may not be true, but Pamelta, which is also included in the Kreisgrabenanlagen sort of bucket, if you were, was actually contemporary. It's a very, very much later a monument on the continent with a ditch and bank, several ditches and banks, and timber constructions on the inside. And this is contemporary with Stonehenge. Now, because there's a tourism aspect involved here, there has been quite a drive to associate Pamelta with Stonehenge. And the site of Pamelta has therefore been embellished because there's a complete reconstruction of it and it's been painted. It's got carved skulls in the posts. It's got designs and, you know, the designs they've taken from the pottery of the time. You know, what designs were on the pottery they've incorporated. But they're very much, and I use the word advisedly, selling it as a ritual site because they want that it's Germany's Stonehenge. They want it associated with Stonehenge.
Yes, and on that basis, they've given it lintels, timber
lintels.
They've
given it lintels.
It's the only place that anybody has done that, as far as I'm aware. Mm. And obviously there can be no archaeological evidence to support that. You couldn't possibly say that a site had timber lintels. There would be nothing to show. So am I unreasonable to say that I think it's even a little bit naughty to have reconstructed it in that way?
Maybe, you know, it's certainly you're running your flags up the flagpost, isn't it? And once it's done, it's done. And people's minds will be, I think, well, this is how it was. Well, no, don't think so.
Mm.
So, all right, folks, has that been controversial enough for you? Has that stirred the pot a little bit? I hope you see where we're coming from on this this whole subject. And, you know, as we say, dig a little deeper.
Yes.
It's not quite as simple as...
I was hoping that it would have clarified things, but now I'm thinking, have we clarified anything? Yeah, henge. Cirque in Monument. Ditch inside the bank. That's a henge.
No, we just completely muddied the waters, Rupert.
Oh dear.
It's our job. Anyway, whichever we've done, clarified stuff, muddied stuff for you, disappointed you or enlightened you. Thank you. Thank you for watching, folks. Thank you again to our Patreon supporters.
Yes,
always. See you around soon. And with that, I think it's time to say goodbye.
And see you next time.
Cheers, folks. Bye.